Radio. Welcome, my name is Henrik Palmgren and we are coming to you from the west coast of Sweden. If you want to hear more radio and read news on all kinds of different topics that we find interesting, intriguing and of course important, please go to our website redeyescreations.com where we also have videos, films, interviews, audio commentary, TV programs and much more for you. Today we're going to talk about the Oklahoma City bombing back in 1995. Holland van den Nieuwenhof is a native of Oklahoma and formerly served in the U.S. Marine Corps as a rifle squad leader. His broadcasting career started in 2007 as a co-host on Radio Free Oklahoma and later as a co-host on Free Mind Report. Holland is also the writer and producer for A Noble Life, Oklahoma City, 1995. This is the first full-length documentary examining the Oklahoma City bombing in the light of new and suppressed evidence that proves the official story to be a myth. James Lane is also with us in the first hour. He is the director of the documentary. He was born and raised in Oklahoma and has been an information technology professional for over 12 years. They both join us to shed light on answers long ignored and censored about the Oklahoma City bombing. Right, this is going to be really, really interesting. We have with us on the line Holland van den Nieuwenhof. First of all, good to have you with us. Thank you for coming on the program.
Oh, thank you, Heinrich. It's a pleasure.
Excellent. And then also joining us, we have James Lane as well. Thank you to you as well for coming on.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
Absolutely. It's going to be a lot of, fun maybe is not the right word, but it's going to be an important program, that's for sure. You guys sent me a DVD a couple of weeks ago here. I've rewatched it again. Today, and it's very well made, first of all. It's thorough and really clear and shows, obviously, how the official story is full of holes, as we get it to us, the Oklahoma City bombing. Back in 95, and I thought we could go through some of the basics. This is, after all, 17 years ago now. We might even have some of the younger audience with us here on the program that might not even remember the full story. So either one of you who could kind of just begin and give us the background on the story, that would be great.
Well, I think that it's interesting that you bring up that some of the younger listeners may not be as familiar with the subject matter, and that's something that you're going to get when you watch this movie, is whether you know everything about the Oklahoma City bombing or nothing, you're going to walk away with something from this movie, because there really wasn't anything that has been put out in the last decade. And there's been so much research that's gone on through the Oklahoma Bombing Investigation Committee, headed up by State Representative Charles Key, the ongoing investigations by people who were working on the film, Holland, Van den Nieuwenhof, Chris Emery, Wendy Painting, and then Jesse Trinadue, in addition to, you know, numerous other investigators. And we wanted to compile all of that into one cohesive package that a person could sit down and really get the broad overview of what the questions are about the official story of the Oklahoma City bombing. We started out with enough material to probably create a miniseries, a 10-hour movie, and we boiled it down to just the most provable essence and eyewitness testimony to get it down to 2 hours.
The official story of the Oklahoma City bombing is that on April 19th, 1995, in Oklahoma City, a disgruntled U.S. Army veteran named Timothy McVeigh drove a Ryder truck packed with several thousand pounds of ammonium nitrate fertilizer and diesel fuel, an improvised explosive called ANFO for short, and that this truck bomb detonated and was responsible for the damage to the Murrah building that killed 168 people, including 20 children in a daycare center in the building. The official story states that McVeigh did this because he was enraged at the federal government because of its actions at the siege of Waco, which had ended in a catastrophic fire 2 years to the day before the bombing. With A Noble Lie, we demonstrate that the official story is false, that there were other people involved with the bombing besides McVeigh and the few convicted accomplices, and that many of these people were government informants.
Absolutely. It's a really interesting story, and the way that you guys laid it out is really well made in the documentary, chapter by chapter, and you go through it, and I hope we can touch upon some of these points here today, because they're really, really important as other similar cases, if I can put it that way, has unfolded in a similar manner. For me personally, when I look through
the film, I can see that there's many points that dovetails with what happened recently here in close to me over in Oslo. So it seems to be the same kind of MO, I guess, and we can certainly get into that. But I guess I'd like to ask you guys first, when you first began looking into this, James or Holland?
Well, now, I actually came on board a little later in the investigation. Now, Chris and Holland, you know, had been doing their research for many years. I came on board to actually, you know, bring the movie, you know, production forward. But, you know, everything has been built, you know, on, you know, the research of the past. So, like I said, you know, it's really a combination of a lot of different folks' work. But for me, you know, it was the fact that, you know, I'm an Oklahoman. I was born and raised here, you know, and we know that there were other perpetrators involved from, you know, all of the information that we have. And I, you know, I feel a responsibility, you know, living here to expose the lies and try to bring, you know, the perpetrators to justice, even those that were involved in the cover-up. You know, people say 17 years on, why do you still care? Why don't you just let it go? Well, a lot of people that were involved in the cover-up are still in positions of power today. Look at Eric Holder. You know, 2,000 people have died from Fast and Furious, the scandal with the ATF, mm-hmm. and he's heavily involved with that, you know. And so the body count continues to rise until these people are held accountable. You know, there's nothing to stop them. And as one of the bombing survivors, V.Z. Lawton, said, without truth, there is no justice.
That's right. Absolutely right. Is that one of the, obviously agreeing to the ATF agents, the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives pretty early in the movie. There's controversies there and inconsistencies. Why don't we talk about that a little bit first?
Well, the office of the ATF was the supposed target of the attack because their involvement with Waco, and their office was in the Murrah building. But no agents were injured or killed in the bombing, despite the all the other offices in there. And we have affidavits, which we show in the movie, and eyewitness accounts that the ATF agents who arrived immediately after the bombing were telling more than one first responder that they had been tipped by their pagers to not come into work. They had been given a warning which was not passed on to anyone else in the building. After the bombing, some agents started concocting stories to say that they were inside the building. One agent said that he was in an elevator that went into free fall after the bombing, and then he forced his way out. And, of course, heroically rescued several people, although no one can attest to this. We do interview the elevator mechanics who arrived before the fire department. They pried open the elevator from the outside. They verified that, one, none of the elevators went into free fall, and, two, all of the elevators were empty at the time of the bombing. So this agent's story is a lie. Another agent claimed that he actually was knocked unconscious in his office, and after chopping through several walls, of course, again, rescued a bunch of people. But he was actually sporting a bandage on his hand a couple of days later when he was telling the story. But in a noble lie, we have footage taken by the Sheriff's Department of this same agent standing outside the rubble of the Murrah building. He's not disheveled. He's not covered in concrete dust like every other victim. And one hand he's holding a water bottle, and the other hand he's shaking the hand of the head of the Oklahoma City bomb squad. So his story is a lie.
Interesting. So they were there right away. They received witnesses you have in the movie talking about the bomb van, I guess it is, and close by being there. There was activity and suggestions that they've been at least there the whole day, but as we'll get into this, this must have been planned for weeks, if not months ahead, of course. But what are some of the witnesses say about this, that there was activity there, they knew that something was going down? Obviously you said that they were warned, first of all, the ATF agents, their office, and again, that sounds like 9/11. We hear same echoes coming out through there, that certain offices in the World Trade Center, got warned, as it were, and didn't show up that day. So that's an interesting connection, too.
Well, there's a lot of evidence of foreknowledge. We have a legislator here in Oklahoma, Iztook, Senator Iztook. And one of his assistants actually said that, we knew this was going to happen, that their office knew it was going to happen. And they said that in front of two sheriff's deputies who have, given sworn affidavits that what they heard that day. To this day, Iztook denies having any foreknowledge, but refuses to take a lie detector test. Both of the sheriffs have agreed that they would take a lie detector test as to what they heard that day. There's other evidence of foreknowledge. It was the bomb squad was there in front of the courthouse that morning before the bombing. Their excuse is, oh, he was running routine errands. Yeah, you go pick up your dry cleaning with the bomb squad truck. Okay, that makes sense. So there's things like this that make us question it. But then, you know, when you get into some of the testimony of the survivors, like Jane Graham, she was a survivor that day. And, you know, after the bombing, she started to see other videos, other people talking about stuff. And she started to put the pieces of the puzzle together. And she actually saw people in the basement of the Murrah building before the bombing. This was, I think, 3 days before the bombing, working with plans and wire and what she thought was putty. She thought they were working on the telephone systems. But as she describes this, other people with, you know, explosive expertise, you know, say, well, this is how you set up C4 with dead cord. And some of the players that she saw there are actually threads that tie the whole story together, such as Andreas Strassmeyer, which I'm sure we'll get into a little later.
Interesting guy. By the way, how many guilty have there been now in total from the point of view of the official story? Tim McWay, we know that, then Terry Nichols, but there's some other people in there as well. Maybe we could clarify that as well.
Well, according to the official story, only four people in the entire universe knew of this plot, that being Tim McVay, who is supposed to have driven the truck by himself and parked it in for the Murrah building, despite the fact that everyone who saw McVay the morning of the bombing with the Ryder truck saw him with other people, which they could simply clear up by releasing the videotapes, which they have not done thus far. The only convicted accomplice was an old Army buddy named Terry Nichols, who helped McVay build a bomb in Kansas, a couple hundred miles north of Oklahoma City, the day before the bombing. Terry Nichols testifies that what he built with McVay was not a bomb. He was being forced to cooperate, and he just went along with what McVay was making him do. And there's a lot of evidence that suggests whatever they put together in Kansas was not what exploded in Oklahoma City. And the only other two people were Michael and Lori Fortier. And Michael Fortier was another Army buddy who had advanced knowledge of the plot. They both turned state's evidence and disappeared in the witness protection program.
Well, there you go. So they are not in – are they in jail today, or where are they?
Michael Fortier did serve a short sentence. Lori Fortier did not, and they are whereabouts unknown.
All right. Interesting. So we have the many people coming out and talking about at least two, but in some cases even three different people, John Doe 1 and 2, I guess, they have been referred to. And this is something I've heard for a long time as well. Why is impossible to answer, I guess, for your guests, because it's such a stupid thing that is, you know, unfolding in this case. But why isn't the footage being shown? What's the excuse? How can this even be allowed, you know?
That's the question. I mean, you know, as Han was saying earlier, you know, it's 17 years on. Why can't we see the videotapes? And you talk about other parallels. I mean, it's very similar to, you know, the Pentagon and various other incidents where, you know, we never get access to the video. Every single witness that saw Timothy McVeigh the day of the bombing saw him with an additional perpetrator, including the prosecution's own witnesses. So, you know, we know that there was other people involved. Jesse Trinidad, in his investigation, has uncovered FBI documents that says that the suspects exited the vehicle. Suspects, not just one. There were multiple people.
This was a Secret Service timeline that they were taking. They were writing down what they were watching on the videotape, which we've never seen. And it actually said 3 minutes, 6 seconds after the truck was parked in front of the building, suspects, plural, exited the truck.
Yeah. Now, we know that the FBI duplicated over 400 tapes. Now, this is going to include cameras that were on multiple different buildings downtown that day, including the ones that were on the Murrah building. Officer Don Browning, he's Oklahoma City police officer, retired, said that that morning he saw the people in FBI jackets taking the cameras off the outside of the building. So we know that there was plenty of footage from the documents and the eyewitness. But every time that there's been an effort to get it, they let out a little bit of video, and then they say it all goes blank, you know, at 9:02. Nothing shows the outside of the building. It's all interior shots or just, you know, random traffic that doesn't matter. And they say, well, they were all changing their tapes at the exact same time, 9:02 a.m. So different buildings, different companies, different security departments all decided to change their tapes at 9:02 a.m. It's ridiculous.
Right.
And as Jesse continues to push for through the Freedom of Information Act get access to these videotapes, he's continually blocked on every turn. And luckily, he's working with some judges in Utah that came up through the private sector and have a little more sense of justice, and they continue to push back on the FBI and say, no, your answers aren't good enough. Go back, look again, go find those tapes.
Mm. Jesse, he had obviously a personal invested in the story, I guess we could say. His brother, Kenneth Michael Trandeau. What happened to him? Can we talk about him briefly?
Yes. Kenny Trandeau was picked up on a parole violation in California, a very simple, actually, misunderstanding, and flown to the Federal Transfer Center in Oklahoma City, 2,000 miles away, just a couple of weeks after the bombing. And they thought this was weird. His case was in California, but it was no big deal. They talked by phone. They were going to get him a lawyer, and they really didn't expect him to do much time at all, if any. And Jesse Trentidu was his brother. He's an attorney. He's a civil attorney out of Salt Lake City, Utah. The next word they get from the government is that their son and brother had committed suicide in jail. And this was totally a surprise, and I mean, there was no reason for this. And when they get the body back, it's covered in bruises. There are bruises on the soles of his feet, fingerprint marks on his biceps, his throat has been slashed, and his head caved in. The Oklahoma State Medical Examiner actually told Jesse Trentidu that it was a torture murder. Jesse Trentidu won a wrongful death lawsuit against the government, but he still didn't know why they had killed his brother. And he was later leaked information that his brother had fit a profile of someone who may have assisted with the bombing, someone with a bank robbery history. Kenny Trentidu had the unfortunate circumstance to bear a striking physical resemblance to one of the suspected John Doe number twos, mm-hmm. Richard Lee Guthrie. Mustache, build, even same tattoo, but they were different people. Apparently, the FBI thought that he was John Doe number two, this Richard Lee Guthrie, and they tortured him to death. But to this day, now, after a year of searching, the FBI now says that John Doe number two never existed. But they believed it to the point where they were willing to kill a man. Because of that, Jesse has been pursuing truth, knowing that it's tied to the bombing, even though it was just a coincidence. He is now determined to avenge his brother's death by embarrassing the FBI as much as possible.
Well, I certainly understand that. He is definitely driven. There are some other people you mentioned here as well, including Charles Key. He has done a lot of good work on this, and he seems to be really honest. He was, I don't know when he began his investigation or even why, but maybe you can clarify that and some of the work that he's done.
Well, State Representative Charles Key, he's a real hero to me. I really appreciate his bravery in facing the, you know, onslaught of criticism for actually pursuing truth and trying to hold the people accountable. He had constituents that were coming up to him and saying that they had additional information that contradicted the official story, that they wanted him to pursue this and try to get some sort of independent investigation. And so, to that end, he helped form founded the Oklahoma Bombing Investigation Committee, along with Del Phillips, a real pillar of the community, a business leader, B.Z. Lawton, a bombing survivor, and another gentleman, George Wallace. And they hired investigators, followed up on every lead that they got, and went to Congress to ask for a hearing. And they said, well, compile the information you have and bring it back to us, and we'll try to get a congressional hearing. Well, they did that. They published what is called the final report, and it's available on Amazon.com. And when they bring it to Congress 3 weeks later, 9/11 happened, so it got completely overshadowed.
Wow.
And it's, I think, a great work that hasn't been given enough attention and was really the foundation for the documentary.
Very, really interesting. The full title is A Noble Lie, Oklahoma, 1995. Run by us the idea of A Noble Lie. It's a good concept.
Sure, sure. And, you know, if folks, go to anoblelie.com, they'll be able to see, some of the background and why we chose this title. But A Noble Lie is based off of Plato's The Republic. It's a lie told by the elite to maintain social harmony or the position of that elite. And we see this in the Oklahoma City bombing, be it no matter what you think the motivation was behind it or who was ultimately responsible, I think that it's plainly evident to everybody that the people in positions of power capitalize upon the event to further their own geopolitical agendas. At that time, you know, we had a major stall in the U.S., a lot of opposition to globalization. They were, you know, taking, deindustrializing the United States, taking all of that offshore. People were resisting that. They were resisting the expansion of the police state powers and the abuses of our, you know, natural rights secured by the Constitution. And it seems like after the Oklahoma City bombing, if you questioned the government, if you questioned their abuses of the American people, well, now you're a McVeigh. And that just shut everybody down. You know, they say, well, you know, you're one of those right wing extremists that is going to, you know, kill kids when nothing can be further from the truth. But it was used to, you know, destroy opposition.
Yeah, stifle dissent. I see the same thing in the Norway case. Now, whatever whoever really is behind it and so forth, it's evident that they are they're using the tragedy, the bombing for their own political purposes and advantages. But for a person that wouldn't understand how a government obviously can do something like this, or how does this benefit them more though in the long run? Is it simply to discredit people who are critical, or is there something else, something more behind this? What do you think?
Well, I do think that perhaps there's a deeper agenda at work, because in the United States in 1995, this was before the age of terrorism. In 1995 in the U.S., you didn't think about terrorism. You weren't scared about anything. In fact, we had no external enemy. The Soviet Union had fallen. The Cold War was over. We had vanquished Iraq in the first Persian Gulf War. And people were looking in for once. There was no external enemy to keep us distracted. And people were seeing a lot of things wrong with this government. And they weren't scared. But Oklahoma City changed that. It kind of inaugurated this new age of terror we live in that was amplified under 9/11. Here in this country today, I mean, it's kind of strange for me to be saying this, but there used to be a time when it was different, when you weren't scared of terrorism, when your rights were not being taken away in the name of Osama bin Laden or some other boogeyman.
Yeah.
So perhaps that was at work.
So we have, was it 93, the first World Trade Center bombing? I believe it was. Then we have 95 Oklahoma. Is it? And before that, by the way, we have the Branch Davidian thing unfolding, and then 2001 World Trade Center again, obviously. But Oklahoma is really one of the big ones, I guess, that's in that they kind of sets this whole process off. And so maybe we can talk a little bit about what this suggests, basically, the idea that at least a faction within the government probably is responsible in one way or another. Maybe we can elaborate a little bit on that and furthermore how that was pulled off, because it seems like if they'd done it to begin with, then it's understandable in a way why they would have to cover up so many consequent people that have been asking questions. We're going to get into some of these more here. There's plenty of murders, if you will, around this whole case as well, which is incredibly tragic. But again, why... Or how did the government pull this off? For what reasons, and how did they actually do it, if we can talk about the mechanics of it for a little bit?
Well, I mean, I think we see this as a standard operating procedure through all the events. I mean, be it, you know, 7/7 in London, be it, you know, Oklahoma City, 9/11, you know, the Port Arthur massacre. I mean, all of these events have very similar structure around it, where there is either a training exercise or a sting operation that's going on at that time. 1993, Ahmad Salam was actually given live explosives by the FBI. And he got so nervous about it, he starts recording his conversations with his handler. That's out in the open. He goes in the witness relocation program, never to be seen again. You know, the underwear bomber, most recently, that issued in the you know, age of the body scanners at the airport. You know, that was a well-dressed man helped him get on there.
That's right.
You know, there were other people involved. Very similar here in Oklahoma. We know that ATF informant Carol Howe, who was working out of a white separatist compound in eastern Oklahoma called Elohim City, was telling the ATF that there were the people at Elohim City that were scouting locations in Oklahoma City to set off a bomb. You know, to the point where she was, you know, she's like, stay away from federal buildings in April, you know. So we see the other players involved, like I said, specifically Andreas Strassmeier, German foreign national with ties to, you know, different intelligence institutions. he comes to Texas and is seen entering a federal building with a key code by the militia that he was supposedly, you know, trying to work with. Well, they immediately kick him out and send him on his way. He goes to Elohim City. He's there at the same time that we have witnesses at Elohim City that say that McVeigh was there. They're seen together in multiple locations. There was a strip club there. They see, again, they saw Strassmeyer in the basement of the building before the bombing. So, you know, we see these types of players involved. And then the fact that the ATF was there that morning, you know, in their full raid gear, ready to go, you know, it looks like this was a sting operation that went bad. In addition to that, we had a congressional aide tell the Oklahoma Bombing Investigation Committee that that's exactly what it was. But, see, that's not to discount the government's part on it or whatever – you know, powers within the global oligarchy, let's say, that may have had influence to take an operation live. What that's saying is the rank and file bureaucrat and agent were not participating knowing that 168 people were going to die that day. They were participating in a sting operation. It only takes a small group of people to actually take that sting live. Now everybody's going to act on the axiom of their own self-interest, right? They're going to be involved in the cover-up to preserve the institutions, their pensions, their careers, you know, because their fingerprints are all over everything.
Mm. So can we suggest that, well, if we begin to look at the mechanics of the nature of the bomb, we understand that something more must be involved. But maybe we can touch upon that right now, the idea that this is a, what's it called again? I mean, it was a fertilizer bomb, basically, but an ANFO, A-N-F-O, the ammonium nitrate fuel oil. Bomb. What's your comment on this?
Well, the official story dictates that the only cause of destruction of the Murrah building was that truck bomb parked in the street. But there are several problems with that story. The three seismographs at OU and at University of Oklahoma and other locations around Oklahoma recorded two energetic events up to 10 seconds apart that they interpreted as two bombs. 14 eyewitnesses have gone on to testify that the building was shaking and coming apart before the windows blew in, a sizable gap 8 to 10 seconds apart. That's consistent with the seismograph evidence. For the purposes of the movie, we interviewed Air Force General Benton K. Parton. He ran the U.S. Air Force's armaments laboratory for a number of years. He spent his career blowing things up and doing analysis. He conducted a bomb damage analysis at Oklahoma City and concluded in the Parton report that up to four explosives had been strapped to interior columns within the building. Because the damage to the Murrah building is somewhat problematic, there is a tremendous bite out of the northeast side of the building that goes almost all the way through the building. It's and that bite is dramatically offset from the crater. It doesn't line up. And that's where the majority of the casualties were, and that's where Parton could see that the columns had been strapped with explosives because there was missing concrete, the identical failure pattern at every joint. There was missing concrete and exposed rebar, which indicates that they had been uniformly strapped with an explosive. The Air Force themselves later conducted a simulation of the Oklahoma City bombing, trying to use the formula that the official story dictated. They concluded that there were bombs inside the building. So on one hand, you have the Air Force saying officially, in there, through the U.S. Air Force Armaments Laboratory, that the truck bomb theory is not consistent with the evidence. And then you have the spokesman for the Justice Department saying that the truck bomb was, so they can't even get their story straight.
Well, in addition to that, one of the hallmarks of an ANFO bomb is the ammonium nitrate gas cloud. Every time that these have been set off in history, be it Northern Ireland or Sterling Hall here in the United States 41 years ago this August, the first responders are usually hospitalized from the inhalation of nitrogen gas. We know that that didn't happen in Oklahoma City, which calls into question what the primary explosive was actually in the vehicle that pulled up.
Mm-hmm.
So we had many survivors that, you know, they're walking out, they're no problem with respiration. One of the first people on the scene to, you know, taking part in rescue was Officer Terrence Yakey. He pulled Tom Hall out almost immediately and continued to save about seven other people's lives that day, a true hero. No problem with respiration whatsoever.
Tell us a bit more about what happened to Yakey. This is a tragic story.
Officer Terrence Yakey, like I said, was a true hero. And, you know, when he filed his first report about what he saw that day, it got pushed back. They said, no, trim this down. You know, it's too much. It's not accurate. He was telling his family that as the official story was unfolding in the media, that that's not the way it happened. That's not what he saw that day. And he had some sort of information that he was trying to take to a storage locker. And he said, he was talking to a friend, and he said, as soon as I shake these feds that are following me, we'll meet up for lunch, you know. And he was later found dead. He had multiple lacerations on his arms, on his neck. He bled out enough in the vehicle to, they said you could dip it out with a ladle. He, the official story on this actually says that he then crawled a mile away and committed suicide by a tree. Well, we're supposed to believe that with rope marks on his neck, handcuff marks on his wrist, grass all in his, the wounds in his arm. Okay. And then now he's going to, he's dragged a mile away and then, shot at a downward angle from the top of his skull coming out of his jaw at a far enough distance not to leave powder residue on his head. The law enforcement that arrives afterwards is unable to find the weapon as soon as the FBI lands, because that was federal land that, that he was on. As soon as they land to participate in the investigation, they immediately find a weapon. No ballistics test was done. No autopsy was done, which is completely contrary to what happens to every other police officer in Oklahoma. No matter what type of accident they're in, or no matter what was involved in their death, they get an autopsy. Terry never got an autopsy. And they declare his death a suicide. They never ask his family if he was suicidal. And quite the opposite. His family is telling them, no, he had everything to live for. You know, he just reconciled with his wife. He had just got a promotion. He was getting the key to the city. You know, it was a happy time in his life. And so, you know, this was a real tragedy. And, you know, we would love to know what it was that Terry knew.
Yeah.
But I think he was holding back the information to protect his family. And there's new legislation that passed here in Oklahoma last year that says that if your family member's death was declared a suicide, you can now contest that. And so we're hoping to capitalize upon the momentum from this movie to get a new investigation for the death of Terrence Yeake.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. So again, I'm back to this idea. What is it that is so incredibly important to keep secret? Is it simply because he had information that basically could point fingers at those truly involved? Is it just because of the fact that there is inconsistencies in the story, and this is a guy who has contradictions to that, and he's a police officer, he's a credible witness in that case, and therefore they simply had to take him out? Is that how things unfolded, do you guys think, or why this happened?
Well, the information we were given is that Terry Yeake heard the multiple explosions, which directly contradict the official story. He was just blocks away at the bombing, when the bombing happened, writing a speeding ticket. And he also, when he pulled up, he was the first officer to respond. And when he first pulled up, he noticed that there were several federal agents, not based in the Murrah building, but based in offices several miles away, the FBI headquarters. Some of those agents were standing outside the Murrah building watching things unfold. They shouldn't have been there watching that. There was rumors he had a videotape of some of this. When Terrence Yeake died, he was 3 days away from receiving the Medal of Valor, the highest award the department can offer. And he was getting the award despite the harassment and intimidation he'd been given. They couldn't deny him his medal. And he was also resigning from the police department. He was done with the Oklahoma City Police Department. He was tired of the injustice and tired of the lies, and he was moving on. And I don't think that Terry Yeake could be allowed to give that speech. He had nothing to lose. He was leaving, and the cameras and the media would have been pointed at him. And he cannot be allowed to give that speech. He cannot be allowed to present that evidence. After he died, we know that the FBI raided his bank and looted the contents of his safety deposit box without a warrant.
You're kidding.
The bank just caved in. And we don't even know what's in there, but the FBI took it.
Wow, that's incredible. It's unbelievable. Talk about being above the law. So, I mean, again, if we discuss the bomb a little bit here, then was there, do you guys believe that there actually was a bomb in the vehicle that was parked outside? I mean, this is potentially the one that actually created the crater underneath, but then there was a second string of bombs inside the building, or how do we explain it to move away from the official, you know, phony version here?
Well, I mean, there's no doubt that there was a truck and some sort of explosive in there. You know, that's undeniable. But what was the explosive that was in the truck? Holland's got some additional information on that possibilities. But I mean, there is no doubt there were additional ordnance inside the building. Some that did go off, some that didn't. And, they were pulling the additional ordnance out, the unexploded ordnance out. We've got 2 or 3 minutes of just quick clips of people talking about the additional bombs, the media showing the bomb truck pulling up, them taking the bombs out, the Air Force personnel saying that the bomb that they disarmed was actually larger. than the one that went off. And so, I mean, there's no doubt that there was, you know, additional ordnance.
So was this a sloppy operation?
Well, actually, it was. The original plan was, you know, it took me a while to figure this out because the Ryder truck before the bombing was seen, like, basically circling the Murrah building and driving all over downtown. It wasn't making any sense until you realized that they were trying to park it in the parking garage. But the fools hadn't calculated the height clearance in the parking garage. The truck was too big to fit. So they actually drove away to high ground in Oklahoma City where they were seen, the two drivers, two people, mind you, were seen huddling in the car, in the truck for up to 20 minutes. I think they were trying to communicate the foul up. And then they went and drove it in front of the Murrah building. Had that truck exploded in the parking garage, it would have been much harder, much more problematic to disprove the official story of the damage to the Murrah building. If it had been underneath the building, it must have been much more easy to explain the damage. But as it was a screw-up. It wasn't supposed to be in the street. And there was a bomb in the truck, but it mainly served to destroy the truck and destroy that evidence. I mean, there was a couple just down the street in the Regency Towers. They were inside the lobby when they heard bombs going off. They didn't know what it was. And they ran out to their car to look after their child who was in the car, and then the axle came flying from the truck and hit the car. I mean, there's just no way that they would have had to process everything, run out to the car, and then get hit by the axle. I mean, there's a lot of evidence and a lot of eyewitness testimony that there were two separate events.
Yeah, I mean, the FEMA report states that the blast wave from the truck was traveling at 1,700 feet per second. And you explained to me how the survivors had time to think, oh, it's an earthquake, and get under their desk before the glass blows in through the windows.
Right. So we have that interesting scenario of you detail in the movie really well with the schematics and everything. Column B3, we have the skipping of B4, implying again that we have different charges placed on different columns inside the buildings. And so if this is the case, who has the power, who has the means to get access to this and run an operation? Is it the federal government with the cahoots of the police, or again, could it be a more smaller rogue element that could have pulled this off? Is that possible?
Or it could be both. You know, again, maybe it's, you know, government agents and bureaucrats involved with it thinking it's a sting operation, and then that criminal element with, you know, allegiances outside of, you know, obviously our best interest, take it live. You know, because we've seen this happen before, and that seems to be the methodology.
The information we've developed is that the bombing was supposed to be a big publicity stunt. They were the original intent was to blow that building up at night. That's how they got the column strings with C4 and plastic explosives. That's why the agents did that. And federal law enforcement is pretty much infamous for staging events to make themselves look good. And federal law enforcement was facing a lot of criticism in 1995 over Ruby Ridge, the fiasco there, killed three people, and the Waco incident. And the ATF was facing a lot of scandals beyond that. People were openly talking about dissolving the ATF. And then you have the Oklahoma City bombing. And it was supposed to be at night. That's the information we've developed, but that's not what happened. The truck showed up in the morning. The bomb went off. The bombs inside also went off in the morning. And now everyone's in cover-up mode because it was their truck, their bomb, their informants. The person in the parking garage seen with plastic explosives, Andy Strassmeyer, is a government informant. In the recently released book, Oklahoma City, what the investigation missed and why it still matters. That just came out last week by Roger Charles and Andrew Gumbel. They go over a report from a CIA Inspector General agent who recalls that in that time frame, 1995, he went over documents that named Andy Strassmeyer as a government asset sharing information with both the U.S. and the German governments. So we have an informant inside the building with plastic explosive. I don't know if he knew what the final end of that was going to be, but we know what the result is going to be. There's going to be a massive cover-up.
And it's always, you know, legislation. Oklahoma City was a precursor to 9/11 in a lot of ways. There was anti-terrorism legislation that was expanding the police state powers that was opposed before the bombing. After that, it sailed through with hardly any dissent. You know, and we saw the same thing with the Patriot Act with 9/11. You know, they capitalize upon these events, you know, to enact, you know, legislation that normally people wouldn't even begin to tolerate.
That's right. Absolutely. They take the opportunity, if they don't even create the events, obviously, that we're alluding to here, themselves to begin with. If something like this happens, in some regards, it seems to be that they take down their guard and actually let it happen, and then they capitalize on the event itself. Andy Strassmeyer, interesting guy. We have this, you guys go into this in detail in the DVD, towards the end, I believe, with this Wild Bill from the Air Raid. Maybe we can talk about that and his connections to Strassmeyer. And this all of this circles around Elohim City, it seems like. And again, we have a scenario where we have potential then government infiltrators are taking themselves into these groups, and then it seems like they are being used for different purposes. And it goes back to someone like Lee Harvey Oswald. They're double agents, triple agents, that at the end it seems like they don't even know who they're working for anymore. There's layers within layers. But is this in any way, can we clarify some of these question marks in any way?
Yes, there was, at the time of the bombing and before, there was a massive federal operation in effect called PACCON, which stood for Patriot Conspiracy. And it was a plan to infiltrate every right-wing and so-called neo-Nazi group in the U.S., and implicate them in firearms and explosives felonies to take out the radical right. The PACCON is very hush-hush. Very few documents have leaked, even though it was a huge operation. They're really keeping a lid on it, but there's more information developing. J.M. Berger of IntelWire just released an article last week again on PACCON. And I believe Elohim City, according to Jesse Trintadue, his opinion was a PACCON operation. Elohim City had been a relatively quirky kind of cult-like existence. And then when Andy Strassmeyer arrives as chief of security, he starts inciting them to action, making them buy weapons, telling them there's going to be a standoff, scaring them, provoking action, which we see is consistent with these federal law enforcement sting operations where they infiltrate a group and they talk them into committing action, and then they're all arrested. And this plays into the sting operation that went awry on the hands of federal law enforcement. But all it takes is a couple key moves to be made, and the operation goes live, goes hot, and they have a gigantic mess on their hands. Andy Strassmeyer's fingerprints are all over this. Richard Lee Guthrie, who was later killed in his jail cell, he was suicided in his jail cell after the FBI mistakenly killed Kenny Trintadue, thinking it was him. Mm. And actually, the cellmate across the way from Kenny Trintadue was later killed also, hung in his cell. So you have three deaths tied directly to Richard Lee Guthrie, who they thought was John Doe number two, who was a roommate of Andy Strassmeyer at Elohim City, and also a roommate, they all live together, of Michael Brescia, a man who bears an uncanny resemblance to the John Doe number two sketches. There's just all this evidence, and we've just laid it out to you about Andy Strassmeyer. You know what the FBI investigation into Strassmeyer was?
No.
After he left the country by way of Mexico and flew back to Germany, it consisted of one phone call from a federal prosecutor and an FBI agent, a teleconference, where he was simply asked if he had anything to do with the bombing, and he said no, and that was the end of the investigation.
Yeah, and something else
that was it, huh? Yeah. Yeah. Go ahead.
And something else that Jesse Trintadue uncovered was the fact that the CIA actually had a satellite pointed at Elohim City the morning before the bombing. You know, I mean, if there was no interest there, then why point this, multi-million dollar military spy satellite at a little white separatist compound in Oklahoma?
Very interesting. Are we primarily talking about patsies here, potentially? I mean, again, if the whole operation, if we talk about Elohim City, is, well, maybe, okay, granted, maybe it's not created and set up day one by the government. It's actually, you know, set up by some neo-Nazi group or something like that, and then the government infiltrates that with X amount of people or even one, and then eventually they might have so many people in there that they kind of take over the operation and then steer it into the direction that they want to be able to use the group to pull these kind of idiotic stunts off. So we have some people in there that might be working for the government, obviously, without knowing it. But if we look at someone like McVeigh, it's more of a kind of interesting character in that sense. Can we be clear and just classify him as a patsy? Yep, he knew that he was working for the government, or is something more going on with McVeigh specifically? He, after all, got the death penalty from this, so why didn't he speak out if he was framed or set up about this?
Well, going back to the controlled opposition, it turned out later that the founder and leader of Elohim City was making $400 a month as an FBI informant, so it turns out the whole thing was an FBI operation. McVeigh was a patsy, and we're not saying he's innocent by any means. He helped drive that truck up, and he knew exactly what he was doing, but he was following orders. He was by no means the mastermind of anything. Everyone who knew McVeigh said that he was the perfect follower, not a leader, incapable of independent action. We've interviewed people who were in the Army with him. That's the consistent opinion. He told his lawyers, he told Terry Nichols, he told his own family that he was working undercover for the government. His lawyers believed him and backed out.
Very interesting. So he just never maybe got an opportunity then to speak out in any way. I don't recall how his handling was. Again, I can just look at the Breivik case here in Oslo and see how incredibly hush-hush everything. And I can imagine that it was similar with the handling of McVeigh, correct? What do you guys think?
Yes. We don't know why McVeigh kept the silence. I have interviewed a defense investigator who sat across the table from McVeigh, and McVeigh told him that he had given his word to his other conspirators that he wouldn't implicate them. I believe he was following orders. We don't even know if he died. There are no autopsy was performed on his body.
Right.
Which is the standard procedure for all executed federal prisoners. It's always happened, but they don't do it in this case. They say they cremated him. And what's funny is on his death certificate, it lists his employer as U.S. Army. He had been in the Army for 9 years, had several different jobs, and it lists his occupation, not his veteran status, it lists his occupation as soldier. So perhaps he was a soldier until the end.
He was still taking orders in a way. I mean, how far can we go with that? People are talking about Manchurian candidates and everything else. I don't know if we necessarily have to go there, but I don't know. There's still possibility, I guess. What do you think, James?
Well, I mean, that's one of the questions, you know, that a lot of people have. Why wouldn't he talk? Well, one of the possibilities is the appearance of a psychiatrist, Dr. Jolyon West. He actually confers with the defense team and sees McVeigh. He has worked with Petty Hearst, Saran Saran, and Jack Ruby. Under further investigation, you find that he was actually probably number two in the country at the time on psychological warfare methods that have been honed and continue to be used today, you know, as interrogation techniques, etc. So, I mean, the guy was, one of the founders of modern mind control. You know, what's he doing, conferring with the McVeigh defense team? Wendy Painting uncovered additional information that his protege, Dr. John Smith, who actually took over the situation there with McVeigh, is now working at Guantanamo Bay.
Wow.
So.
Very, very interesting. We certainly have much more to discuss, and I want to leave the last, 5 or so minutes here. If there's any specific points you want to raise at the end here of the first hour, I again want to give out the website, of course, anoblelie.com. You guys can see trailers there. You can obviously order the DVD straight from there. But let's see if there's anything else we should cover in these last 5 minutes in the first segment, guys. What do you think?
I think that, again, we're going to continue to pursue the case with Terrence Yeakey. We're going to be working with the family get a new investigation, get a new autopsy. If you want more information about his story, you can go to tytruth.com. We're actually going to film every step of the way, working with the family, trying to open the investigation, and hopefully that will be another documentary that will come out maybe on the 18th anniversary.
But the fact is, the bloody shirt of Oklahoma City is waved to the state, a demonized dissent. But the official story is untrue. In fact, it's a wet paper bag. It's one of the most demonstrable cases of an official story being false. And when people see this movie and see that governments are capable of lying to such an extent about mass murder, about every step of the way, that they're capable of other even greater crimes. Because here's the thing, people here in the United States, they're not afraid of Oklahoma City anymore. They're still scared of Islamic jihadist terrorism, but they're not scared of Oklahoma City. So they're able to look at this evidence objectively without being scared. I mean, the weight of evidence for 9/11, Oklahoma City, and these other events is very, very heavy and definitely leans in the way of government involvement. But people have a hard time confronting that fact, especially when that threat, that manufactured threat, is being waved in their face. So they can look at the Oklahoma City bombing, see that a false flag attack is possible, can be carried out by a government against its own people, that it is historical, and perhaps when it happens again, in this country and other countries across the globe, when their governments resort to this false flag tool, the people will not cooperate with whatever horrible agenda is in store for us. Just if we expose the methodology, we rob it of its power.
Absolutely. I want to ask you a little bit more about some of the, I guess, how the film has been received. Have you guys tried to reach out to, I mean, I don't know if you're seeking even attention in the mainstream in that way, but have you tried? And if so, how's that gone down so far?
It's going very well. We're actually working on international distribution. We've submitted to many film festivals. Official selection at the Vegas Independent Film Festival, a finalist at the Rinalda Festival, and we just won Best Feature Historical Documentary at the Bare Bones Film Festival. Mm. So it is being received, and I think that, you know, it's due in part to the methodology that we all agreed on, which is, you know, we're not going to make wild accusations. We're just going to deal with documented evidence and eyewitness testimony and leave it up to the intelligence of the viewer to discern for themselves what is factual and what is not. We establish emotional credibility in the beginning of the movie with the victim's family members. Then we establish the technical credibility with technical experts. When you combine all of that together, it's an excellent tool that you can take and show to the uninitiated or, you know, folks that don't necessarily share our worldview and expose them to this type of corruption and crime that's perpetrated by the state.
That's right. It opens up those really scary doors, the possibility that we might have people in charge and in control of certain things in a way that don't have our best interest at heart. And that's it's a tough one to go through, but it's an important one to go through because it opens up to so many other things. And again, as we mentioned here, the case dovetails with so many other cases around the world and the MO, and we've seen it all over. And it's, I mean, fairly known, if you will, in one sense, that government uses these atrocities to further their own agenda, as we've said, and also just take the opportunity to. It's weird though, because it's like they have to. I wonder if they would step away if we would have this kind of level of so-called terrorism. It seems to me that they're behind the majority of it, and which is like that's insane when you think about it, that they are the ones who have to actually continuously have to push that there's people out there who want to kill us, who want to murder us, and there are terrorists everywhere. But if they would have let go, people are generally good-hearted and things would be, fairly fine. So I don't know. Maybe I'm too naive in that way, but it certainly seems like it, because the more and more of these cases we investigate, it seems like there's, they always have the tentacles up to the very elite, to the very top. So.
Exactly, anyway. And that's why exposing false flag terror, it literally saves lives, folks. I mean, we saw that with the underwear bomber. One of the witnesses that saw him getting on the plane says that he had questions about 9/11, and so he was determined not to allow a cover-up to happen there, right?
Yeah.
So, I mean, as we start to expose false flag terror for its true nature, we're literally taking that tool away from the oligarchy to where they're not able to do that anymore, and it's literally saving lives. That's why it's important to expose these types of crimes, understand the truth, tell your friends and family about it, and get the truth out.
Absolutely. Okay, we're talking with Holland van den Nieuwenhof and James Lane, and we are going to take a little short break at this point. There's a more website here, so I want to give out as well. We're going to carry on in the next one, speaking with Holland alone. James has to leave us. We're also going to say bye to you. But again, then, nobleeye.com. Then also you guys do a weekly, daily radio show? Tell us about that.
A weekly radio show on the Logos Radio Network. It's called freemindreport.com. It's on Monday nights, 6 to 8 p.m. Central in the United States. And we're also heard on 19 FM and AM stations across the United States. And we deal with a lot of this related material, exposing current events and the deeper agenda at work.
Absolutely. Okay, hold on. Stay with us then for more, and we'll say bye to James Lane for now. Thank you for joining us, James.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
Absolutely. So in the next segment, we're going to talk more about, I want to talk more about the media, obviously, how they've been treated, and there were some interesting aspects there to how they actually covered it accurately in the beginning, and then it more and more deteriorates as the feds kind of take hold of the whole situation, and then, of course, they finally decided to pull the building, as Silverstein would say, I guess, as well, covering up all of the evidence basically there. So there's some of the things we're going to talk about next. But thank you, James, and we'll continue talking with you, Holland. Stay with us. We'll be right back with more after this. We proceed in the second hour talking with Holland van den Nieuwenhof, discussing local news reports in Oklahoma after the bombing and how the feds arrived to manipulate the story. However, Channel 4 reported true facts surrounding the events for an entire year, but eventually were silenced and bought out. We'll discuss politicians and other prominent figures involved in the cover-up in Oklahoma City and their psychology. Van den Nieuwenhof mentions important testimony of government informants surrounding the incident. Holland makes ties with people involved in the Oklahoma City bombing and 9/11. We converse about true heroes and feds who are talking. We'll end speaking about why it's becoming harder to hide false flag attacks in our present day and real terrorism versus fake terrorism. If you want to continue to listen to this second hour and all of our previous programs in their entirety, subscribe to Red Ice Creations and get full access to our member section and all our archives going back to our start in 2006. Radio, TV programs, video, interviews, films, audio commentary, and music as well. Research, perspectives, speculations, philosophy, conspiracy fact, food for thought, and so much more. It's €5 per month. Try out a 3-month subscription, or you can choose a one-time payment, either 3 months or all the way up to 2 years. You can download every single show if you so please. We have well over 500 programs there now, probably coming up to 600 here soon. These are in-depth interviews on all kinds of different subjects. If you stay with us, you will be able to hear Tom Horn, Diana Johnstone, Cliff High, Louise Turi, Dean Clifford, John B. Wells, Ian Crane, Neil Kramer, Richard Merrick, Peter Halldorsson, Nora Gedgaudas, Britt D. and Tom Secker, Richard Grove, Winter Lake, Alex Newman, Eric Kallström, and Jordan Maxwell, to name a few. Our second hour with Holland van den Nieuwenhof is next.